This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On this Inauguration Day 2013, the second inauguration of Barack Obama, we got to wondering about the highs and the lows of presidential inaugurations through our history. Who better to satisfy our curiosity than Gleaves Whitney? He directs the Hahnstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University, and he's written or edited 15 books exploring our presidents and the governors of Michigan. Welcome, Gleaves.
Hi there, Cindy.
Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Well, this year brings kind of an unusual inaugural doubleheader. We're actually getting two, one private and one public. Explain this for us.
Well, this often happens when you have a Sunday and then a Monday. And, of course, it's stipulated in the Constitution that it's going to be January 20th. But it often happens, you know, where you have to have two inaugurals. It sometimes happens because of a Sunday event, or sometimes the weather has forced this to occur. So we've had a variety of arrangements for inaugurations over the years.
And so today will be the big public inauguration. And one of the moments that I think the nation has really come to expect is that that presidential strut somewhere along Pennsylvania Avenue when the president and first lady hop out of their armored limo and they walk a spell. And this really is not an old tradition, is it?
No, it's really not. And I tell you, it's interesting that Carter went the whole length because he wanted to make a statement about simplifying. And, of course, his inaugural, the whole thing costs so much less money than these things typically cost. So simplicity can be a virtue. Getting out to the people can be a virtue. I mean, let's face it, President Barack Obama has had rock star appeal. When you look at what happened in the first inauguration back 4 years ago, a very, very attractive candidate, and a president who comes in with a lot of hope attached to him. And it's just a nice touch. You know, we're so overprotected. Of course, we're having gun debates right now, and when the presidents decide to get out and the first lady get out and are closer to the people, it's really a hit.
I will note the first ladies have to do the walks in heels.
They sure do. Now, they better be filling all the cracks on Pennsylvania Avenue.
You got that right. You don't want Michelle to break a heel. So who was the first president to be sworn in Washington?
It was Thomas Jefferson in 1801, because prior to that, the Capitol had been in Philadelphia, and prior to that, New York City, where George Washington was actually sworn in. And that first inauguration of Jefferson's is famous because that's where he said, you know, we are all Republicans, we are all Federalists. This is one of the great bipartisan statements in all inauguration history, and it had been just a bruising campaign. You and I have talked about that before.
Yes.
And, I mean, really, it sank to the depths. Nothing in recent years went as low as our founding fathers went in 1801. So Jefferson very graciously reaches out to the Federalists whom he had defeated and tries to assuage, you know, their pain for having lost and really disappearing as a party.
Well, am I correct that John Adams actually skipped town rather than face Jefferson's inauguration?
Oh, absolutely. John Adams would have nothing to do with it, and they weren't able to kiss and make up for another 13 years.
But they finally did do that.
Yeah.
So looking back, what was the most surprising moment in your opinion? I saw something about a cowboy and a lasso.
Oh, boy, Dwight Eisenhower. I mean, that is certainly one of the most odd moments. When he was in, Eisenhower was in a grandstand, and of course he was born in Texas. A lot of people associate him with Kansas.
Yes.
But this cowboy rides up to him, I guess striking up the Texas connection, and lassoed the president. And this was in January 1953. And that surely would have caused the Secret Service all kinds of fits.
I would suspect. I shudder to think what might happen if someone tried that today.
Well, there were two surprises, really, with the Eisenhower inauguration. One of them is this cowboy incident, which is so funny. But the other is really striking in retrospect. I think that Eisenhower was the first and only president to write his own prayer into the inaugural address.
Okay.
So that was kind of different. We aren't used to presidents being like priests or preachers at their inaugural addresses, but it's his gesture was a first.
Speaking of the speeches, who had the shortest speech?
Oh, that was George Washington's second inaugural address. the Abraham Lincoln, you go back to him, he details why we even have an inaugural address. Of course, it's not really prescribed in the Constitution. All the Constitution says is the president will address the Congress on an annual basis and take the swearing-in oath. But Washington decides to make a statement, and Lincoln later, some 80 years later, describes the mission statement. He says the president should make a statement that's detailed of the course to be pursued. That's the mission. And Lincoln's ability to do that, of course, is a master of the language, created one of the greatest inaugural addresses ever in the second inaugural address. Washington, by contrast, with his very short inaugural address, said, hey, all of you know what has been going on, so I'm not going to detail what we're going to be doing. And, of course, you didn't have the mass media in that day to broadcast it, so there
That's
wasn't
true.
The urgency to do so.
In fact, certainly the inaugural speeches have been the president's big moment to shine, and over the years, some of them have made the most of that bully pulpit. Let's take a listen.
So, first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
So, Gleaves, tell us how our second inaugural addresses, like the one President Obama gives, they are different from the first, just as you told us with George Washington. Hey, you know what I'm about. Do most presidents have a different tenor in the second address?
I think so. First of all, second inaugural addresses usually occur after the president has been chastened by experience. I mean, the lofty optimism that often characterizes first inaugural addresses is missing. Now, this can be a little bit different. For example, George W. Bush, 8 years ago, kind of went out on a limb when he needed to backtrack a little bit and explain why we were in Iraq. And for that reason, he talked about the Middle East being really a fruitful ground for freedom, a new birth of freedom in the world. So sometimes they can be lofty like that, but typically, second inaugural addresses are more sober. I mean, look at Abraham Lincoln's, where he's saying our country has been chastised through the Civil War. Both the North and the South, the people have prayed to the same God, they've read the same Bible, but this country has suffered so much, and he's looking into the inscrutable will of God to try to figure out what has this country been through. Second inaugurals are often very forgettable. They don't typically have the one-liners that we remember first inaugurals for.
Now, talk to us about the longest speech, which also, I think, leads to the category of dumbest things a president's ever done at his inauguration. And hello, William Henry Harrison, we are talking to you.
Oh, I tell you, and it's flu season. This is a great time to remind ourselves of how dumb people can be. It is a macho thing about some of these presidents, and William Henry Harrison decides to go out there. There's a howling snowstorm. He gives an oration between almost 2 hours long.
Whoa.
And without his overcoat, without his top hat, and he ends up in bed for the next 30 days, and then he dies.
Died of pneumonia, didn't he?
I've got to add, Cindy, that particular inaugural address is one that historians love because Harrison actually gave the details of what a Whig presidency should look like, and it's one of the great statements that we have of Whig policies and first principles. So it's too bad he died. I mean, it would have been interesting to watch how he would have tried to enact these things.
That's interesting, but it's a good document for study at the very least.
Well, the same thing happened actually with John F. Kennedy. Let's go back to the 35th president.
Yes.
And that sparkling, we had that snowstorm go through the night before, and it left this sparkling city with all the glaring snow, and Kennedy wanted kind of to make a macho gesture. I mean, he was not the old Eisenhower. He was the new young buck, and he was going to give that inaugural address without a coat, and he did.
Curious as far as the weather, when it comes to extremes, who got the best and worst from old man winter?
Well, it happens to be Ronald Reagan. He got the best and the worst. His first inaugural was delightful. I think the temperature went up to about 55 degrees, and it was kind of a a symbol from Reagan's point of view that the country had turned the corner. It was no longer the winter of the Carter years where, you know, there'd been talk of malaise and all that business.
And literally, am I correct that the Iranian hostages were released during the inauguration?
Yes, wouldn't you know it? Yeah. I mean, the sunshine came out on the American spirit because those Iranian hostages were released as sort of the ultimate up-years to Carter.
Boy, wasn't it though.
Oh, gosh, terrible. And then 4 years later, Ronald Reagan, just to balance things out, had the coldest weather to contend with. In fact, they had the formal ceremony actually was in the rotunda, and he was sworn in inside because it was so cold.
Gleaves Whitney, talk to us about parties. Which presidents had the rowdiest celebrations? Because isn't it true that once we, the common people, could have gone right into the White House and put our mud-stained boots on that White House carpet?
Well, I tell you, Andrew Jackson, the father of more of our populist democracy, had a real great party. That it was so bad that people were jumping in and out of the windows. And in fact, one brain got the idea, get all of the liquor, all the beer out on the lawn so that people would go out the windows and out of the White House to party out there. But the other rowdy one, of course, was Lincoln. I mean, that was a pretty good party that the soldiers had to actually come in and help police.
There you go. That is a party. So we're ever so much more sedate today.
are. But you want to be on the A-list of these things. I mean, look at all the balls. I mean, you've got just these great extravaganzas. People go, this is one of the most unifying social events. It's almost up there with the Super Bowl. It's unifying people from all backgrounds, all over the country, come together. They want to be on those A-lists. They've written to their congressman to get a seat at the inauguration itself, and then they want to be part of the parties. And it's just one of those fun times when we can just let our hair down and enjoy unity as a country.
And we could all use a little more of that.
We sure could.
Gleaves, thank you so much for joining us today.
Cindy, it's a pleasure.
Gleaves Whitney directs the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University, and he has written a number of books looking at our presidents or the governors of Michigan, and we have anointed him stateside's presidential historian.
Thank you.